This is the State of Things live from the Upstage Cabaret in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. Thank you. Hate crimes targeting Muslims, their mosques, their businesses, and other parts of Muslim life have tripled in 2015. That's according to a study by California State University at San Bernardino. And Islamophobic rhetoric is now a steady feature of political speech, and it's gotten worse since the deadly attacks in Paris and California. But how are Muslims in North Carolina affected by this, and how is it changing public dialogue in the state? An ongoing series at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro explores these questions through an event called Ask a Muslim Anything. The gatherings are a forum for a conversation on all aspects of belief, identity, and practice. They're free and open to the public. The next event takes place Tuesday, March 1st, but I'm joined today by a panel of guests who are going to help us recreate that event right here. Deanna Kelly Sayed is a writer and the series coordinator. Deanna, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Amber Kahn is a counselor who works here in Greensboro. Amber, welcome to you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And Carl Lute Williams is a writer and longtime Greensboro resident who is one of the founding members of Greensboro's Islamic Center. Welcome to you, Carl. Deanna, let's start talking about the origins of this event. How did it come about?
Well, I'm a writer, and I hang out a lot at Scuppernong Books, which is right down the street. And the owners at Scuppernong approached me one day and said, you know, we are really concerned about the current political rhetoric and we want to do something about it, and you're the only Muslim we know, so what should we do? And I proposed, well, why don't we have a forum called Ask a Muslim Anything, and we just kind of sit around and talk. It was a joke, but they liked it and they ran with the idea, and it's a wonderful example of bringing many different Muslims together, but also how important the role of an independent bookstore can be in a community that's committed to intellectual life.
We'll talk more about the diversity of Muslim life. I think one of the goals, once you decided on the name and the fact of it, was to highlight diversity among Muslim Americans here in North Carolina.
Very much so. There is this idea among non-Muslims that a Muslim may look or act like a certain way. And I know that for those listening, you can't see us, but I'm a white woman, and then we have some more diversity on the panel. You would never know that I'm a Muslim. And that's the truth among many Muslims, that we're not visibly Muslim. We may not have a cover on our head. We may not look foreign. We may not speak with an accent. But we're here, and we're part of your community, and we're making change in your community, positive change. And I wanted to break this idea, to shatter the stereotype that Islam is a monolith, and invite many different Muslims from all different walks of life to share their story. Because that's how we build relationships, is to put aside the ideology and share personal narratives about how we live in the world.
Would you share some of that story with us now and your journey to Islam?
I would love to. So what do you want to know?
I want to know, because you did convert to Islam, is that not right?
I did, yes.
So tell us about that and about that decision, and then sort of what it's been like for you.
I grew up in the rural South, right at the Florida, Georgia, Alabama state line, which we call Florabama, and I was raised Southern Baptist. My grandmother took me to church that my ancestors built in the 1870s, but I was always a seeker. I was always interested in this, in the idea of the divine. And I was not always happy with what I was taught in the Southern Baptist Church. No offense to Southern Baptist, but it left me wanting a little bit more. I became active with the Palestinian cause in college, and that's when I was introduced to Muslims. Many of them were communists. They weren't necessarily practicing Muslims, but they defended Islam. And as I studied the faith more, I came across this beautiful quote one day that said, in Islam, the heart bone and the mind bone are connected. So to be cognizant of the divine means you not only have to intellectually engage the faith, but you also have to think with your heart. And I thought that was such a beautiful way of connecting to God.
So then you've converted. And as you say, if we had an image in our mind about what a Muslim looks like, you wouldn't. You wouldn't fit that. The caption wouldn't fit you so neatly.
Well, not now.
So would you? What's been your experience? And what happens when you tell somebody or when it comes out in conversation that you're Muslim?
A lot of people immediately want to know how did you convert, is what people say. I don't like to use the word convert because I'm not a fraction. I'm horrible at math. I like to say that I evolved, I unfurled into faith. I was in hijab for 12 years, and I've lived in the Muslim world, so I've had the normative experience of being a visible Muslim in society, and it's a little bit different when you take off the hijab and you fold back into whiteness. Nobody would ever know I'm a Muslim. But I like being able to surprise people and to challenge their stereotypes, because that's when the best conversations come up.
Amber, you were born and raised in Pakistan, am I right?
Yes, I was born there and lived there until I was nine. So I was pretty much raised here.
But experience in both places. Tell us what your experience of Islam is like, and whether or not how it differed, if it did, from your first 9 years in Pakistan to the rest of your life here.
I think you don't think about it when you're born Muslim as much. I look at, and I hate to say convert, but people who become Muslim or who are not born into the faith, I feel that they practice it, they look at the details and they practice it more thoroughly, or they're better Muslims than me. They give me something to strive for, I think. I thought about it as much until, honestly, I didn't think about what it meant to be Muslim or that I was that different until 9/11, I think. I think that was the point where you really started to look at yourself and look at where you come from and what's happening around the world. So,
How much of that was how you were looking at yourself, and how much of that was the way others were looking at you?
Well, that's a great point. Yes, I think it was a moment to see yourself the way that society is looking at you. I definitely think that was an eye-opening moment for me, for sure.
How did it feel for you? I mean, this is obviously a change. You talked about this moment in which you can point to as a real difference in the way you felt about yourself. How is it different?
I think all of a sudden, what came to light is that there are some serious things going on around the world and in our country, and all of a sudden you're being painted in this way that you're not. So I think what changed is the perception that others had of Muslims. I say that I'm grateful to grow up in this community, because I think Greensboro, and I've said this when we talked at our events at Scuppernong, Greensboro is one of those places that invites this dialogue. So I'm grateful for that. I don't know what it feels like if you're, maybe farther down south somewhere in the U.S. I don't know what that feels like to be Muslim in those places. Again, there are certain parts of Greensboro I probably wouldn't want to go as a Muslim and maybe make that announcement. But I think that overall this community is open to that dialogue. But I think I started to look at the national, perception of what it means to be Muslim.
Carl, you've been a practicing Muslim for more than four decades. Can you tell us a bit about your journey?
Yes, excuse me. I was born only about 45 miles from here in Danville, Virginia, which is where I grew up. My father was a civil rights attorney, NAACP attorney. Danville was one of the hotbeds of the civil rights movement. So I grew up as a young person. My mother and father didn't allow me to go to what they used to call mass meetings during the civil rights time. But it was a very, as you well know, volatile time in the 60s. So I'm kind of a child of the 60s in that sense. It wasn't long after that that at 15 years old, I became a member of the Black Panther Party. I didn't tell my mother and father that either, but I absconded to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where there was a branch of the Black Panther Party. Actually, what happened is a friend of mine and I were watching television, and we saw Black Panther members with berets on their head escorting Malcolm X's wife to court as she was after he was assassinated. And we liked the fact that they were standing up for what they thought was right. So we adopted some of that and found that there was a Black Panther Party branch in Winston-Salem. So we went and joined, and I, at 15 years old, I was arrested on Main Street in Danville, Virginia, for selling Black Panther papers. But the story of coming to Islam, let me get to that, which is that the Black Panther Party, well, I thought they had a very relevant political and social ideology. I didn't, their moral basis was not to my liking, and they asked me to move away from home to the Panther House in Danville, and I was saying, how am I going to eat the three meals that I'm eating at home right now from selling Panther paper? So anyway, when I went to Howard University, I was introduced to Islam. A friend of mine introduced me to Islam, invited me to the masjid, and I saw what I thought was a political, social, and moral way of life that was very, that resonated with me.
I'll take a break right there and come back and continue this conversation with my guests, Deanna Kelly Sayed, Amber Khan, and Carl Williams, all participants in the ongoing series at Scuppernong Books called Ask a Muslim Anything. We're going to continue that conversation in a moment. First, we're going to hear some music on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the music of Kelsey Ledbetter. Stay tuned.
Sponsored by the evolution of a new revolution, immediate involvement of realizing a paradise should be at the tips of our fingers and not only in our minds. Who are you to judge? Who are you to judge? Who are you to judge me on who I should be? Who are you to say that I cannot live a certain way? If the world began with everyone being free, we wouldn't have to fight or hide just who we want to be. I wish I didn't have to say this, but fight for your rights, stand up and fight, and fight, and fight. 'Cause you could be straight like that, or you could be gay like that, or you could be weird like that. You are who you say you are. You can be shaped like that, or you can pierce your face like that, or you can wear your hair like that. You are who you say you are. You can be shaped like that, or you can pierce your face like that, or you can wear your hair like that. You are who you say you are. I said you can be straight like that, or you can be gay like that, or you can be weird like that. You are who you say you are, so be free.
This is the State of Things, broadcasting from Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today about an ongoing series at Scuppernong Books called Ask a Muslim Anything. It invites the community to a discussion with a diverse group of North Carolina Muslims on topics ranging from belief to identity to practice. And I'm joined by three of the series participants. Deanna Kelly Sayed is a writer and co-founder of the series. Amber Khan is a counselor who works in Greensboro. She's participated in one or two. Carl Lute Williams is a writer and longtime Greensboro resident who helped found Greensboro's Islamic Center. And before the break, Carl, you were talking about looking for something that had the kind of moral and political grounding you were looking for, and you found that in Islam.
Yes, I did. I was a student at Howard University. I accepted Islam at the age of 19 while I was a sophomore at Howard. And when I visited the masjid, and I actually saw Muslims pray for the first time, I was very impressed, and I actually ran back to the dormitory and told all my friends that used to be engaged in all kinds of political and social discussions that I had found the real truth and the real correct way of life, and they quickly dismissed me very quickly. Mm.
What do you think was at the heart of that, at their dismissal?
Just unfamiliarity, and this was 1974. You know, becoming a Muslim is a deep step, for sake of a better word, you know, and their mentality, when I told them over a period of about 8 months that I was telling them I was going to become a Muslim, they really were kind of like challenging me. It's not, you know, one of those things like, I don't believe you're going to do it. You're not going to do that. You're not going to stop doing all the things that we've been doing in college, those of which, many of which I won't mention. But
were you ever attracted to the Black Muslim movement, Malcolm X, and that movement?
No, I wasn't. But I don't know particularly why, because they were in front of my dormitory every Sunday back in 1974, and they used to be out there calling, you know, come on, black man, come in and find out about your history and learn about yourself. I don't know. I think that maybe a little bit of my upbringing with the civil rights movement, which was interracial, it was not just black folks. Even with the Black Panther Party, it wasn't just black folks. I wasn't particularly interested in an ideology or a philosophy that was only talking about one race of people.
What has been your experience? We were talking about this uptick in Islamophobic rhetoric and even action, anti-Muslim behavior, and threats. Have you experienced it, and how so?
Really, truthfully, none at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think because, first of all, you know, I am 100% American. I was raised in this country and socialized in this country. Even though I wear a kufi, which is a little hat on my head every day to kind of for people to identify me as Muslim, I'm not seen as being, I guess, foreign. Mm. I'm actually a sports writer. I attend basketball tournaments and football games. And
would you say it's having an effect, though? So you haven't, and again, we're talking about appearances and the importance of that in this whole conversation. Would you say it's having an effect?
It's certainly having an effect, but I think that there's a perception that Muslims are from other countries and are foreign, and a lot of the backlash has been directed towards people who sound differently, who speak a different language, speak with an accent, look a particular way. I mean, you've seen evidence of even Sikhs who people appear or think they are Muslims because they cover their head and because they have a long beard or long mustache or other kinds of things. So no, I haven't experienced it, but I've certainly had to speak about it on many occasions on television and radio, trying to explain a lot of the things that are going on. I've been in that position quite a bit.
Amber, you have talked about this, and you are a counselor, the effect of this kind of language on the psyche of people who are targeted. Tell us more about
that.
Yeah,
as a counselor, that is very important to me. As an American, it's important to me that my community is healthy. I don't care if you're Muslim or not. It matters to me that you're healthy, that we have a healthy community. And I try to contribute to that by being involved in different organizations in the community. If there's an event, I usually try to be there if it interests me and if it goes with something that I can contribute to. So it's definitely important to me. It doesn't matter who you are. Mental health is important. So when you're when you have somebody who has a great influence, somebody who's running for president, I'm not going to say any names, but someone who is, you know, directly saying things against Muslims, it can have an effect because you know that person has an influence, and that person might not be there to listen to the follow-up of, you know, whatever so-and-so has said. They might not listen to maybe something nice they might have said about Muslims. What if they just listened to that one thing and then they took that one thing and that's just what they kept in their mind? And I could have never imagined that, you know, we haven't had a tragedy like this in our own community, but just, you know, in Chapel Hill, I could have never imagined something could happen that terrible so close to home. That shook me. But again, it shakes me when anybody is killed in my community. Again, it's as an American, you can't help but feel for the whole community, no matter who is hurt. So, yeah.
Deanna, talk about the event at Scuppernong, how it's gone. I'd be interested to know what you've seen. And by the way, I should point out the Scuppernong book was bookshop here in Greensboro was just named by Southern Living Magazine as one of the top 20 independent bookstores in the South, according to Southern. Right. So it's a Scuppernong Books has created this space. What's gone on? How are these conversations gone?
Well, we are very proud of our bookstore, and kudos to them for creating such a space for dialogue. We, when the series first started, a local independent newspaper, Yes Weekly, did an article on it, and the response was phenomenal. I think the first event, we had about 55 people. The second event is at least maybe 70. And what is fascinating about it is that we sit around in a circle, and we talk to one another. We take questions from people, any question. No question is too stupid or weird. And we answer them as individuals. We do not always have a collective voice, and that is okay, because no Islam, no religion has a collective voice. And it's been a wonderful way not only for people to learn about Muslims in their community, but for us to learn about people who are also in our community who aren't Muslim.
Well, we decided to recreate some of that here since we're in a public space upstairs from the Triad Stage in Greensboro, and ask our studio audience here to ask questions, and they have some. And so, please go ahead.
Okay, well, I'm Barry Strulson, and I'm from Greensboro, and I was taught that the only stupid question is the one you don't ask. So I have actually, what you've said today has really changed the gist of the question I have. All right. I've been led to believe that in the Quran, all right, the head bone and the heart bone are connected, okay? And yet, we see so much violence, physical violence, especially in the Middle East and lately in Europe. And it seems to be condoned, especially between Shia and Sunni. And what, you know, what's the feeling? What is it that, what is it that promotes this, and what, and is it condoned by the Quran?
All right. Anybody want to take that?
I'll be glad to try. But let me make sure I understand your question. You want to know, is what condoned? Is violence condoned?
Right. That, yeah, especially what's, you know, what we read about.
You mean amongst the Muslims or
amongst Muslims? The Muslims in particular, yes.
No, it's not condoned by any stretch of the imagination. It is absolutely abhorrent. There are a lot of reasons for it. Probably have more to do with politics than religion. In fact, probably all about politics rather than religion. You know, we live in a very geopolitical world that everything is, when we can't see anything happen. If you see Shia Sunni violence, believe me, there's a whole lot more story to it than even I know most of the time, but generally it is political. For example, like in Iraq, for example, when America went into Iraq, Saddam Hussein was a Sunni, and the Sunnis ruled the country for as long as Saddam Hussein was there, even though it is a majority Shia country. So when America went in and installed and had elections where the Shia were able to vote for the first time in 30 years and actually elect the Shia government, the Sunnis obviously, well, not obviously, but they rebelled against that. And that's what created the violence. And the only reason the violence wasn't there before was Saddam Hussein, and like many so-called military strongmen, put down any kind of opposition to him. There were no free elections in Iraq before that. So I guess the short answer is that it's more political than religious. Muslims, Sunni and Shia, have lived side by side in practically every Muslim country without killing each other. But when politics enters into it, it takes on a whole nother dimension.
If I could just follow up a little bit on Barry's question, and that is the perception among Americans that there are groups who claim to speak for Muslims, and they claim to espouse Islamic ideals. They're speaking, they say, for a Muslim community, and they seem to be recruiting among people who claim their Muslim heritage, and they're committing acts of violence, deliberately targeting the United States and Western Europe. So in your community, when you get a question like that, I mean, how do you field that question, even if it goes unasked, knowing that that may well be at the root of some of the suspicion?
That's a question we struggle with as well, because ISIS, for example, people who claim to be ISIS, most of their victims are Muslims. So ISIS, these groups are killing other Muslims. And it's, again, it's not about what is necessarily in the Quran or in the Islamic literature. It's about socio-economic, geopolitical realities that have created an intellectual and spiritual vacuum where primarily disaffected young people are finding a voice because they feel disempowered. And I'd also like to point out that many non-Muslim white young men in this country are feeling disempowered too, and they are also gravitating towards, in some cases, towards fundamentalist thought.
Yes, the next question.
I'm Annabelle Link. I live in Greensboro, and I'd like to direct this question to Amber. Do you have a best friend or a really close friend who is not a Muslim? And if so, is it easy for the two of you to discuss religion, politics, and questions like berries?
Yes, I have many friends, and I'm proud of this. I tell people, you know, some people say you're not Pakistani enough or you're not American enough. I think I'm just global. I have friends from every faith background. In fact, I am also on I'm a board member on the Piedmont Interfaith Council, and I'm very proud of that too, of the work that we do in the community, which is just to kind of bridge, you know, people and to continue this type of dialogue where you can talk to somebody who's a different religion from you. So this is just part of who I am. I very openly talk to friends. I have friends who don't agree with me at all politically. I have friends who don't agree with me at all in a lot of ways, but we love each other dearly and have friends for over, you know, 15 years or so. So, yeah.
Thank you.
It's possible.
So we're here at the Upstage Cabaret in downtown Greensboro, reenacting an event that takes place monthly at Scuppernong Books. You're all invited to that, but we're doing it here this afternoon. Ask a Muslim anything. That's the topic today, and you have a question for us. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Carol Davis, and I'm from Greensboro. And my question is, as a Muslim, do you find yourself keeping a low profile sometimes in some places or some circumstances in Greensboro?
Right before, around the end of last year, I actually started thinking about wearing the hijab again. I was toying with putting on my veil again. Just in passing, I just felt like maybe I was at that stage. And I decided against it because I had just, one, lost my job and I needed to start looking for other work. And I felt the hijab might be a barrier. And because I wasn't sure if I wanted to go back out in the world visibly Muslim. And I carried a lot of guilt with that because right now my covered Muslim sisters, they are really taking the brunt of Islamophobia, and kudos to them for being so brave to keep the hijab on. So yes, I have in some ways changed or altered a little bit of my spiritual practice because of current Islamophobia.
And I think that that's always a question that Muslims have to ask and have to deal with, for example, because, you know, we have to, Muslims that are practicing have to pray five times a day. And they have to pray at the most busy times of the day, for example, in early afternoon, late afternoon. And oftentimes, we're not in private circumstances to pray. And sometimes, it's a challenge to decide where you're going to pray. Sometimes you end up praying in your car. When you actually have to stand and bow and prostrate. So, you know, the decision to, and I don't know if those heard President Obama's speech at the prayer breakfast about a week ago after he appeared at the mosque. He talked, his speech was about fear, a faith over fear. And he gave a story of a Muslim who was in the park in Chicago right after the San Bernardino shootings. And he was about to pray, and he had children with him. He decided he wasn't going to pray, and his 8-year-old child asked him, "Why are you not praying, Daddy? It's time to pray." And he thought about how Martin Luther King, during the Civil Rights Movement, was accosted in the same Marquette Park in Chicago by people that were opposed to him when he was questioning segregated housing in Chicago many years ago. And he, as a result of that, put his prayer rug down in the park and prayed. So I think that there's always this question to some degree, not even talking about what Deanna talked about, but just in terms of your regular practice, for example, of prayer, whether you're going to be visible or low-key, seek a private, secluded kind of place to do that. So that is a question that we have to deal with.
Amber, you've talked about this, your experience in this. Maybe I'd ask you about your experience in these public events at Scuppernong, you know, what it's like for you to engage in this very intentional, you know, sort of conversation. It's not just offhand. What's it been like, and what are some of your observations about how these conversations, how we're holding these conversations?
I think we're doing a good job. We're being very respectful of each other and just open to listening. And I think you can say you lean a certain way, whether it's politically or how open you are about listening to other point of views. I mean, heck, some people are not even open to trying new food. So it's, you know, it's hard to try something different. And I think we're doing a good job as a community. We're being very respectful, very open, very engaging. I do think, though, that maybe... we could possibly in the future open it up to other venues. People who come to bookstores, maybe I'm generalizing, are well-read, so maybe they have read what Islam is. So, you know, maybe opening it up more to other areas.
Well, so. Deanna, just very briefly, because I'm pretty short of time here, but the idea that you're having these in very small groups and the Islamophobic conversation is happening on a mass scale, among people who have no personal contact, what's the math here? Can you win it? Can you overtake that kind of mass hate speech that we're seeing in public?
The only thing that anyone can do is start in their local communities and start chipping away at that, literally story by story. And it's not just about me telling you my story, it's about me also listening to yours as well, because we all have spiritual value. It doesn't matter how we believe.
I want to thank you all and all of our audience for sharing all of these thoughts with us today. Deanna Kelly Sayed is a writer and the founder of Ask a Muslim Anything. Amber Khan is a counselor who works in Greensboro. And Carl Lute Williams, a writer and one of the co-founders of Greensboro's Islamic Center. Thank you for being on the program. All three are going to participate in the third installment of Ask a Muslim Anything series at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro. It's going to be Tuesday, March 1st, 7 o'clock, and you can find out all the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we'll talk with a religious scholar and a scientist who are both working to combat climate change. But first, more music from Kelsey Ledbetter.
Have you heard that saying that states mama knows best? And when you break her heart, it weighs heavy on your chest. 'Cause she provides all that we need, the air that we breathe, all the colors we see. It's only a matter of time before she gets fed up, before her love becomes dangerous. Before her love becomes dangerous. You broke her heart and you're not sure if you're ever gonna fix it. You broke her heart and you're not sure if she's ever gonna forgive you for what you do, for what you do, for what you do, you do. For what you do, for what you do, you do. Love your mother earth, respect her dirt, her leaves, her trees, her smile. Love your mother earth, respect her, protect her for all that she's worth. Love her for all that she's worth. Love her, you broke her heart and you're not sure if you ever gonna fix it. You broke her heart and you're not sure if she's ever gonna forgive you for what you do. I said, love your mother earth, respect her dirt, her leaves, her trees. Love your mother earth, respect her, protect her for all that she's worth. For all that she's worth, love your mother.